This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
You can earn $1 million if you are wise and frugal, but once you have $1 million, everybody wants a piece of it and can make a persuasive case for their appeal. The key is to know which appeals conform to and further the missions and causes that you yourself advocate. It was clear to Jim Edwards that Whitworth's mission stood in close conformity with Bill Welch's philosophy of charitable giving. And Jim and his wife, Janie, invited Bill Welch to attend a Whitworth Institute of Ministry in July 2005. This gave Bill an opportunity to walk around campus and to talk with employees of the university, especially to staff in the food services, grounds crews, mailing rooms, and facilities. Bill appeared as an average visitor to Whitworth and identified himself to no one. He wanted to find out whether Whitworth was a suitable candidate for the proposed endowed chair that he was considering giving to Whitworth, and he thought it was important to determine whether the grounds of the university were attractive and well-maintained, whether the employees, particularly those who work in less recognized positions, knew and supported the mission of the university, and whether the president unconditionally supported the mission of the university. His investigations showed that all three of those conditions were met. The Bruner Welch Chair is a testimony to Whitworth University as a community, to Dale Bruner, who the chair honors by its name, and of course, to the scholarly accomplishments that Bill Welch wanted to recognize with this endowed chair and that he recognized in Jim Edwards. Bill Welch's gifts of approximately $1.6 million provided the majority of funding for this endowed chair. Bill Welch originally wanted to name the chair just for Dale Bruner, but Jim insisted, with Dale Bruner's support, that the Welch name be included as well, and hence it became the Bruner Welch Chair of Theology. Jim Edwards has honored that chair by distinguished contributions to understanding and promoting theological heritage of the church and on behalf of the church for both scholars and lay people. Jim's colleague, Roger Morling, will now give a further introduction of Dr. Jim Edwards.
Well, good evening to you all, and thank you very, very much for coming. This is a special treat for me as I get the privilege this evening of introducing my dear friend and colleague, Jim Edwards, for his final lecture in the as Bruner Welch Professor of Theology. For those of you who don't know Jim well, let me begin with a few formalities, and Jim, you can just relax. Educationally, Jim graduated from Whitworth with a major in history. Why history and not theology? I haven't the slightest idea. That's his background. And from here, he went on to study at Princeton Theological Seminary, the University of Zurich, and Fuller Theological Seminary. He's also done postdoctoral study at the University of Tübingen, Tyndale House, Cambridge, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the Center of Theological Inquiry at Princeton. Vocationally, he began his career at First Press in Colorado Springs, a church that a lot of us are familiar with, as associate pastor and mentor minister to students. He then moved to Jamestown, North Dakota, cold country, where he served as professor and chair of the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Jamestown College for 19 years. And then on one of the happiest days of my life, Jim said yes to coming to Whitworth. That was in 1997. And he's been here now for 18 years in our department, teaching a range of courses in theology and Bible. Jim has been a wonderful gift to our department and to the university as a whole. and to all of our students. And we will miss him enormously when he retires this spring. His teaching career has been characterized by three strong commitments, especially. First of all, he's had a strong commitment to his teaching and to his students. Over the years, Jim has taught a range of 27 different courses, different kinds of courses, including a number of study tours to Germany, one of his favorite interests. He's a very popular teacher. He was voted Professor of the Year both at Jamestown and here at Whitworth, and he's received awards for teaching excellence at both schools. Last Friday evening, Dottie and I had some students over to our home, and I wish you could have heard them enthusing about Jim's classes and about his study tour to Turkey in particular. I remember one student saying, "Jim, he's the man."
Whatever that means.
A second strong commitment that Jim has had is to his writing. He's written 7 books, one of which was awarded the Christianity Today Book of the Year Award. He's written 7 shorter commentaries and over 100 different articles, all of them in the service of the church. He has served as contributing editor to Christianity Today and served on the editorial board of the Scottish Journal of Theology and Theology Matters. He's clearly a strong believer in the power of the written word. And on a more personal note, I doubt that the little book that I wrote on Paul recently would ever have seen the light of day were it not for Jim's constant nagging and encouragement. And for that, I thank him very, very much. A third strong commitment that he's had has been to the church. He's a lover of the church, has been all life long. And that is a commitment that is shared by his great wife, Janie, who herself has had a great contribution here at Whitworth, and by his 2 kids, Corey and Mark, both of whom live in Princeton. Ordained in the PCUSA, Jim has spoken in churches and at conferences and at ministerial retreats all over the country. And I think I especially appreciate the courage and the conviction with which he consistently speaks about Christ, about the gospel, and about the authority of Scripture. So, Jim, I thank God for bringing you to Whitworth, to our department, and I thank God for the wonderful impact you've had in so many students' lives over the years. Join me in welcoming Jim.
Wasn't that? Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Roger. Are we not blessed to have colleagues like this? Thank you very, very much. Anything that I would say in response to that would be utterly banal, so I'm going to get on with something that I hope you will be as excited about hearing as I am about delivering. I would like to talk with what happened to the Christian faith in the first generation after Jesus lived and died. Now, I would like, in order to do that, to take you on a fantasy trip just at the beginning of this lecture, and suppose, if you will, that Whitworth were to introduce a new Jan term course, and we will entitle it The Real Quest for the Historical Jesus, Time Travel to First Century Galilee. Now, the course is an interdisciplinary experiment sponsored by both the physics department at Whitworth and the metaphysics department. Now, you didn't think we had one, but it's called the theology department. I teach in it. And the purpose of this interdisciplinary course is to transpose you, participants in this class, back into Jesus' day. It conforms, Beck is here, our president, it conforms to the 2021 strategic plan in every way. It conforms to the experimentation on living human subjects. And above all, to our fulfillment of our slogan and motto at Whitworth of honoring God, following Christ, and serving humanity. In fact, it's especially intended to enhance the second element here of following Christ, literally. Now, it's the responsibility of the physics department to develop this delivery system of getting us from the present into the past. And so they're going to offer tech support to transpose you through time and space and return you safe and sound to Whitworth. It's the responsibility of the metaphysics, the theology department, to teach you enough about Jesus and the apostles to know where you might find him, how to recognize him when you find him, and how to communicate once you find him. Now, the more difficult of these two tasks, obviously, lies with the theology department. After all, there are 2 million people back in first century Palestine, as far as we can tell. And you need to know where you're going to find Jesus. And if you find him, how you will recognize him. And then how to communicate with him. And by the way, would that be in Aramaic, or would that be Hebrew, or Greek, or Latin? It's going to be a difficult task. Now, you need to know that there are some potential perils and dangers in this quest as well. You need to keep in mind that you're a Gentile. And if you happen to transgress the inner precincts of the temple in Jerusalem, you will be immediately killed. Now, Whitworth does not like to lose students on Jan-term trips. So we want you to listen carefully to this. The theology department has serious work to do with you. The physics department does too. They haven't worked out all the kinks in the retrieval system of how you bring it back from the past to the present, but they're optimistic. They still want you to sign up. They fully intend to comply with the federal regulations of no child left behind. So, let's review the crucial data for the real quest for the historical Jesus. You have no reliable information to go on to locate Jesus other than that offered in the New Testament Gospels. Now, according to the Gospels, you're looking for something resembling a movement, as opposed to an organization or a program. And it's a small movement. It's not identified with a building, for example, or a constitutive set of documents. In fact, it doesn't even have a name yet. It's an unnamed movement. Sometimes it's called the Way, but we don't know how widespread that term was or how established it was. The movement is thoroughly rural. It's not that there weren't urban centers in first century Palestine. There were. Jerusalem was a major city. Jesus went there probably more than once per year, but he didn't live there, and he didn't really like Jerusalem. He liked Galilee, and Galilee was rural. It's not that Galilee didn't have major cities. It had two great cities. One of them was Tiberias, where Herod Antipas had his county seat, as we would say. An even greater one was Sepphoris, a great Greco-Roman city. Both of these major cities in Galilee were less than 5 miles from where Jesus spent his entire life, and remarkably, not one reference in any gospel says that he ever went to either place. What this means is that Christianity, from its earliest days in Jesus' lifetime, was consciously rural and village-oriented. The movement, not surprisingly, is Jewish. So there's no need for you to look over onto the east side of the Sea of Galilee. That's all Gentile. That's where the Roman legions are kept. Jesus probably won't be there. You don't even need to look to the southwest quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. That's Jewish Gentile. Not one reference in the gospel ever tells us that Jesus went there. All references tell us that he spent his time upon that Jewish northwest quadrant. If you think of the Sea of Galilee kind of like the face of your watch, you're looking for the shoreline from 9 o'clock to about 1 o'clock. That's where you're going to find Jesus and the disciples. Now back to this language issue. A fair amount of Greek was spoken in the Galilee of Jesus' day, even among Jews. But Greek was probably not their primary language. You need to keep your ears peeled for Aramaic, which is a version of Hebrew, but it's not the same. You're going to have to learn both of these languages. Now, more precisely, you can expect to hear Aramaic in public and everyday affairs. When you're snooping around people's homes and when you're talking in the city gates, you will hear Aramaic. But you will hear Hebrew in religious contacts. That is, when you go to the synagogues, when you're in a yeshiva, at a Torah reading, and in all theological conversations. So if you meet a Jewish scribe, my advice is to start with Hebrew and then shift to Aramaic if Hebrew doesn't work. Now, just some obvious things. Don't expect to find a church on every corner. Actually, forget about church altogether. It hasn't been invented yet. The word and the institution that we associate with it are still several decades in the future. And you'll find Jesus in synagogues, and remember that synagogues meet on Saturday, not Sunday. Now, you can't locate a synagogue by finding a cross on it, nor by simply following people carrying Bibles. They don't have a Bible yet. The New Testament hasn't been written, and without a New Testament, you obviously can't have an Old Testament. There was an Old Testament, although it wasn't called an Old Testament, but it didn't exist in a single codex. It just existed in scrolls. Now, a scroll was about the size of a roll of tar paper that you would cover your roof with, and it weighed about the same amount. People didn't carry them, they carried them in ox carts, and so you're going to have to realize that a scroll is a very difficult thing to find in any place besides a synagogue. The synagogues will meet, and they will speak in Hebrew, not in Aramaic. If you find a document that's written in Aramaic, it won't be a religious document. Synagogue scrolls will have the Torah and the prophets, but they will be written in Hebrew, not in Aramaic, which the Jews said, quotes, pollutes the hands of those who read them. And of course, there will be no such thing as the Pauline epistles or the Gospels. Those are still several decades in the future. So, your mission, should you choose to accept it, can be summarized in one sentence. You're looking for an itinerant teacher leading a small movement that has no name, that has attracted 12 men, but there are many other men and women, occasional adherents to it, in rural Palestine, centered on the northwest quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. It's ethnically Jewish, speaking Aramaic in public, Hebrew in theological discussions, worshiping in synagogues on Saturdays, and reading from scrolls, not codices. Now, while our intrepid travelers are off on their trip, we're going to depart from this flight of fancy and return to more conventional academic discourse as we consider a second scenario. When we read the earliest Christian literature, we discover something quite remarkable. And that is that by the turn of the first century, that is to say, roughly 75 years after the death of Jesus, and that's long enough for one full generation to live. I know that people did not live as old in the Old Testament or in the New Testament time as they do now, but Philo, for one, lived to be exactly 75 years. So did Caesar Augustus. So it's permissible to use this term, a single generation. Within that single 75-year generation, we encounter a Christian faith that conforms to virtually none of the foregoing descriptions of Christianity that I have just given you. Now, some of the changes we find already in the New Testament themselves. For example, the word for church is already used in the New Testament. Another example is that all of the Christian writings that we possess are written, like the New Testament itself, in Greek, not in Aramaic or Hebrew. It's a remarkable fact that there were Aramaic and Hebrew Christian documents. We know there was a Hebrew gospel, but not a one of them has survived. All of our earliest literature is solely Greek. The church will exist by the time of Paul's life as an institution, and we know that already in Acts chapter 11, 26, the way, if it was called that, is now taken the name that we know it today, Christianity and Christian. Other changes that will take place by the time of Ignatius in 105 have not yet happened yet. But we know that by Ignatius's death in that year, he was bishop of Antioch in Syria. He was martyred in Rome in the year 105 or 107, that the church conformed to a totally different picture than the one that I painted for our time travelers to Galilee. If we could visit Antioch in the year 105 rather than Galilee in the year 30, here is what we would find. The movement founded by Jesus in rural Galilee is now thoroughly urban. It's no longer isolated to Palestine, but it's anchored throughout the Roman Empire, particularly on that Antioch-Rome axis that is the major corridor between the East and Rome. The church is now largely Gentile, not entirely, but largely, instead of exclusively Jewish. It has abandoned both Hebrew and Aramaic entirely and shifted into Greek exclusively. And after Greek, it will be followed by Syriac and Latin, but it will never go back to Hebrew or Aramaic. Christians are no longer meeting in Jewish synagogues, but in ecclesiae, in assemblies. We call them churches. Churches are superintended not by apostles, as in Jesus' day, but by bishops. Church services are meeting on Sunday, not Saturday. Sacred scripture is no longer limited to what we would call the Old Testament. That is the Pentateuch, the writings and prophets, but it's now augmented by a specifically Christian type of literature called four gospels, letters of Paul, Peter, and in a Christian apocalypse. These scriptures are no longer written in heavy, clumsy scrolls that you have to unroll, but in the most radical information technology to hit the world at the time, called a codex. A reader-friendly book of leaves that are bound on one side, printed on both sides, and you can open them at leisure to whatever place you want. Believers are celebrating the Eucharist rather than the Passover. By the time of Ignatius, the church has come of age. In short, when our time travelers go back and meet Jesus, they may not know it's a Christian movement at all. It could be that they are seeing an itinerant Jewish rabbi or a cynic philosopher. But by the time you go back into the church of Ignatius, you will recognize it of a place that you go every Sunday morning. In Antioch of the year 100 or shortly thereafter, the Christian church, as we recognize it, has taken form. And the form that we know it in today is the form that it had in Antioch. An original rural movement is now acculturated to an urban environment, a Jewish movement, now primarily Gentile, a Semitic-speaking society is now writing, preaching, and evangelizing in Greek. A once Palestinian movement is now thoroughly cosmopolitan, Greco-Roman. It's actively spreading in the influential Rome-Antioch corridor. It's no longer a synagogue, but a church, no longer meeting on Shabbat, but on Sunday, with a greatly expanded Bible consisting of Christian scriptures in addition to Israelite writings. It's no longer in a scroll, but in a codex. A remarkable set of changes in one single generation. Now, the ancient world was pulsating with associations, cults, philosophies, societies, schools, and mystery religions. Christianity was not the only organization, association in existence. There were Jewish synagogues, there were Stoic schools, there were cynic disciples, there were philosophical schools named after Heraclitus, a half dozen scientists from Miletus, after Pythagoras, Plato, Aristotle, Cicero. There were mystery religions, Magna Mater, sexual cults, grain and corn cults, bull slaying cults, Egyptian magical cults of Isis and Osiris. And finally, there were hosts of associations that we might recognize and call today things like trade organizations and professional societies. The church was one among many. But here's something that's true of the church and is true of not one of those other organizations I just named. Not one of these groups and associations and organizations permeated the ancient world as diversely and as thoroughly as did the nascent Christian movement. The aforementioned groups were formed in particularity, and their existence and identity was inseparable from that particularity. Once their particularity was sacrificed, the essence and the existence of the movement was compromised or extinguished. Now, it's true the Jesus movement was also formed in particularity in Galilee. Jesus was a Jew. But its essence was not defined by that cultural particularity. Christianity succeeded in building a bridge. In reality, it was a series of bridges in many different directions to the ancient world that none of those other associations built. In time, those bridges changed the ancient world. The change is not complete by Ignatius' day. For at least the first century, if Jesus dies in 30, at least until 150, that's more than one century, we do not hear much about Christianity in Greco-Roman sources. It seems apparent that Christianity for at least a century and maybe a century and a half existed largely under the public radar of the ancient world. Nevertheless, by Ignatius' day, the seed is planted, and within two or three centuries, a tree of life will grow from that seed that will have greater effect on the world than the fall of the Roman Empire. Now, these are remarkable changes. But equally remarkable, at least from a modern historical perspective, is that the significance of these changes is rarely recognized. Occasionally, however, they are recognized. Here is what Tübingen's Martin Hengel says. I quote, "The paradox of a crucified messianic pretender being proclaimed as the savior of the world is paralleled by another paradox in Christianity, that a rural Galilean marginal sect became within two generations the drivetrain of a new messianic religion within the great cities of the Roman world." Hengel's spot on. Or Yale's Ramsay MacMullan, even spotter on. The emergence of Christianity from the tangled mess of older religious beliefs, eventually to a position of unchallenged superiority, is surely the single most important phenomenon that can be discovered in the closing centuries of the ancient world. In its impact on the way life was to be lived thereafter in the West, it outmatches even the decline of the Roman Empire. How can we account for this remarkable and unprecedented change? A complete answer to that question, of course, entails a constellation of factors that exceed the limits of this lecture. But it's also true that most important questions have at least an important answer, even if it's not the complete or only answer. In my understanding, the single most important answer to the question is that Christianity's growth spurt is due to the inherent nature of Christianity itself. Christianity is restlessly adaptive because it claims redemptive significance for all of creation. When Jesus included a tax collector in his chosen 12, when Jesus embraced and healed a leper, when he placed a woman by the name of Mary at his feet as a disciple, when he crossed the Sea of Galilee to the Gentile pig-farming Decapolis and sent the first missionary, who was a Gentile, incidentally, to tell the people what God has done for you, end quote. When Jesus did these things and similar things, he was creating the DNA of a movement that resulted in the kinds of changes that transpired between Galilee and Antioch. And when Jesus' disciple, the Apostle Paul, writes from Corinth that he must first go to Jerusalem before he goes to Rome and from there to Spain, now just think about that for a minute. That's like standing in St. Louis and texting your wife that you're going to go to Los Angeles and then to Honolulu, but first you're going to Washington, D.C. We see the irrepressible centrifugal missionary force inherent in Christianity. When that same Apostle Paul asserts that he is a free man, but as a free man, he has enslaved himself to Christ so that he may gain adherence to the faith. He will become a Jew to Jews to gain Jews. He will submit to the law, to those under the law, to gain those under the law. He will become to those without the law like one without the law to gain those without the law. To the weak, he will become weak. To the poor, he will become poor, willing, in fact, to become whatever he needs to become in order to win those in whatever state he finds them. I will become whatever I must become to gain those in whatever state I find them, says Paul, and doing it all so that I might be a fellow worker of the gospel. Paul is telling us that there is a genetic code within Christianity, within the gospel, that generates and forms the church, and the church is not bound by human constructs. The gospel embraces the world, and as its messenger and representative, the Apostle Paul and the early church, and the church of every generation must do the same. Now, the point that I wish to make here is not simply that Christianity survived the tumultuous and inevitable changes when it transitioned from Galilee to Antioch. The fact that Christianity survived those remarkable changes is indeed a phenomenon into itself. But Christianity did more than survive the changes. They were not something that happened to it. There was something at the heart and essence of the Christian movement that actually required these changes, that prompted them. And had Christianity not accomplished them, it would not have remained Christianity. What we see in that first Christian generation, a generation, incidentally, that most historians jump over because they find it somewhat embarrassing. There's no great Pauline, Petrine figures. They have to wait until Justin and Irenaeus and Clement, the great Origen, come about, that they can take pride in them. This generation that is oftentimes seen to be a slump in the faith, a devolution, a period in which nothing happens, is a profoundly creative period. What we see in that first Christian generation is akin to the onset of Christian puberty. Something powerful and transforming that seized the church, and through the church it seized the society. Or if seized is too strong and sudden for that first 75 years, then we'll change the metaphor to yeast and leaven that imperceptibly permeates a solid mass and irrevocably alters it to something greater. In its first 75 years, the early Christian movement changed almost beyond recognition. And the change was not fortuitous or extraneous, but in some way essential and inherent within the movement, required by it. But here is a second and equally important point that I wish to make about earliest Christianity. Everything that Avias said is true. Christianity was uniquely engineered to engage the Greco-Roman world in ways that no other cult or religion or association in the ancient world was able to do. But nevertheless, Christianity did not forsake its essence in adapting to that world. The analogy of hormonal changes is again helpful in illustrating this remarkable fact. The onset of puberty in a 10 or 12-year-old does something that's both wonderful and terrible. Yet it does not alter the young person's DNA. It may alter virtually every other characteristic about that person, but it does not change his or her genetic structure. And I want to quote Martin Hengel again with reference to this point. I quote, "The nucleus," that's Hengel's word for the DNA, "of Christianity, or better, the guiding line, is, in my opinion, the development of Christology, who Jesus Christ was, and not in the first instance church organization. Faith, not social structure, was the propelling power of the early church. Faith, not social structure, says Hengel, was the propelling power of the early church. The essence of the thing we know as the gospel was not eradicated by the adaptations that the gospel brought on. Now, we know of forms of adaptation that are so complete that the essence of the original is entirely eradicated. My ancestors come from England. My wife has just discovered, somewhat to her dismay, that hers come from Germany. But we have both been so acculturated and re-indigenized in America that our German and English ancestry are wholly erased. It wouldn't make any difference if I was Swedish and she was Italian. We would still, I think, be much what we are. But Christianity's characteristic essence was not erased. It was not eradicated by its adaptations. Listen to the way that an early Christian author by the name of Diognetus describes this fantastic dance, this interplay between abiding substance and adaptation to the Roman world. And I quote, "Christians participate," this is the Epistle of Diognetus, chapter 5, "Christians participate in everything as citizens, and they endure everything as foreigners. Every foreign country is their fatherland, and every fatherland is foreign. They marry like everyone else and have children, but they do not expose their children. They share their food, but not their wives. They live on earth, but their citizenship is in heaven. They obey the established laws, but they transcend them. They love everyone, and yet by everyone they are hated and persecuted. They are unknown, and yet they are condemned and put to death, but in dying they are brought to life. They are poor, and yet they make many rich. They are in need of everything, and yet they abound in everything. They are dishonored, yet they are glorified in their dishonor. They are slandered, and yet they are vindicated." And Diognetus completes this poetic memoir of Christianity in these words: "What the soul is to the body, Christians are to the world. What the soul is to the body, Christians are to the world." Diognetus is describing how Christianity is in the world, but not of it. Throughout its major and many adaptations, Christianity retained its essence. And here I must make a most remarkable and unexpected observation. I began by emphasizing the fundamental changes that Christianity underwent in its first generation. The early church, most curiously, makes almost no mention of these changes that I have rhapsodized about. These changes appear to us because we tend to look at history and historiography from a sociological perspective. They appear to us as utterly astounding, and they are. And yet, they are virtually unmentioned in early Christian literature, and if they are mentioned at all, which is very rarely, they are passed over and not celebrated. what appears in the early Christian literature, what the early writers of this literature rhapsodize about, what captures their attention, the one thing that they want to say is not the changes, but rather, to quote Jude 3, the faith that was once delivered to the saints. The early Christian authors look to the oneness, the continuity, the genetic code, the preservation of faith, in other words, that the early church wants us to recognize, rather than their heroic and unprecedented transmogrifications. The continuity that we find in early Christian literature can be summarized in two foci. One is kerygma, and the other is ethics. Kerygma is a Greek word that refers to the church's distinctive proclamation that was characterized always and everywhere by its Christological particularity, namely that Jesus is Lord. The earliest Christian confession is two words, Kyrios Jesus, Jesus is Lord, whose sacrificial death takes away the sins of the world. All early Christian literature reverberates with that truth. And secondly, with an ethics that's complementary, that the distinctive form of life that results from the kerygma was heard, believed, and enacted both personally and corporately. Kerygma and ethics, proclamation and demonstration, theology and practice, the Word of God and the model of the life transformed by the Word of God, these were the treasure in earthen vessels that the Apostle Paul would speak about in 2 Corinthians. If you think about the tension between continuity and change, you will realize that, in fact, this is not unique. All things that endure do so by finding ways to manifest their life force in ever-changing forms and materials. Whitworth University is a perfect example of such, because we have been in existence just a little longer than the time period about which I am speaking. In his spring 2015 convocation address, Professor Dale Soden said this, I quote, George Whitworth would likely be shocked at how we have changed and grown. And yet, I do believe he would approve of the way Whitworth has held on to a core identity centered on an education of mind and heart. There it is again. Great changes, inevitably. Core identity, undeniably. And when the core identity is lost, the organism dies. Evidence of the core identity is ever present and unmistakable in the early post-Christian literature. We find it in persons like Papias, who was little known, or Irenaeus, who was greater known, who never tire of reminding us that their episcopal offices and authority as bishop can be traced back to the apostles. Irenaeus counts back 14 bishops that go back to Peter and from Peter to Christ. This is their way of saying we belong to the tribe of Jesus. We find it in the symbol of faith called the Roman symbol that from the earliest time, already by at least 150, but probably even earlier than that, this symbol of faith that was, in a sense, the talking points of earliest Christianity that became the father of the Apostles' Creed and the grandmother of the Nicene Creed, preserves this continuity. We see it in early texts, seldomly read texts like 2 Clement, Ignatius' epistle to Smyrna, or the Shepherd of Hermas, all of which argue, and I'm quoting here from 2 Clement, that if we do the will of our Father that's revealed in Jesus Christ, we will belong to the first church, the spiritual church that was in fact in existence before the sun and the moon came into being. Let us choose to belong to this church in order that we might be saved. These early Christians are now relating the existence of the church to that of Christ, which existed before time. We find this above all, and I'm going to close with this, in that long and remarkable prologue of Eusebius's church history, the first and greatest history of the church, in which Eusebius begins with four long chapters in arguing that the person of Jesus Christ was present throughout the Old Testament in the form of the Logos, and that the Christian revelation of Jesus Christ was already precedented in the Old Testament, and that the church bears witness to that incarnation in its proclamation of the gospel. In these and other charismatic testimonies, we hear the steadfast conviction of the first Christian generation. They know themselves to be the heirs of a sacred trust, promised by God from the earliest days, a trust that was fully manifested in the incarnation of Jesus Christ in their own lifetimes, to which they have been called as stewards. The words of Jude capture this conviction. Dear friends, I am eager to write about our common salvation, for which I am compelled to urge you to contend for the faith once entrusted to all of God's people. Centered on this faith. Centered on this faith. That first Christian generation. And I believe this must typify every generation in the church afterwards. Knows no boundaries. Thank you.